Hello and welcome to another episode of A Fine Mess. I'm your host, Jeff Giles. If you've listened to previous episodes of the show, you've probably noticed that this one has taken quite a while to come together. In fact, I owe an apology to my guest here, Darden Smith. If I remember right, I think we had this conversation back in May of 2013. It is now December of 2013. If you follow me online, you probably know that the reason for the delay is that I published a book called Landview in the Afternoon, An Oral History of One Life to Live. It's out now. Please buy a copy for yourself and everyone you know. Anyway, the point is that publishing a book and acting as your own publicist and doing interviews for the book and things of that nature have kept me from doing things like this, editing audio and putting it all together in podcast form. But I think I'm back on track now, and here we are with the sixth episode, I think, a conversation that I've been wanting to have for a very long time with a singer-songwriter whose work I greatly admire. His new album, Love Calling, is out now. This was supposed to go up before the record came out. It's now been out for quite a while. You should also get a copy of that for yourself and all of your friends. It is a great record from a great artist, and hopefully you'll get a sense of that in this conversation. Here it is, Fine Mess. Well, we should start, I think, by addressing the fact that even though it's been a little while since you released a record, you're probably writing as much as, if not more than ever, because you are running a couple of programs, a couple of really, really interesting programs, writing programs.
So yeah, you know, the last 10 years of my life have been pretty interesting, and I've written a lot of songs between regular songwriting, writing for records, going up to Nashville, writing songs, and just general co-writing all over the place. Between that and the work I do with Creativity, which encompasses the Be an Artist program, which primarily goes into schools up through, you know, sort of like fourth grade up through seniors of high school, where I use songwriting as a way to show kids about creativity, but the message of that program is more about creativity than songwriting. The songs are kind of a foil to get them to see that they can do more than they've maybe they think they could do, or do creative things that they've never tried, you know, but you can still do it. And then I the Songwriting With program, which focuses on using songs to help people tell stories and to move them to a new place. And that focuses on a couple of different projects. One is called Songwriting With Soldiers, where we put together retreats and I work with wounded veterans. I put together teams of songwriters, and we do like 3-day retreats with wounded veterans and soldiers, active duty soldiers as well, to help them tell stories of and work with trauma. The other place I do that a lot is in a place called Covenant House, which is in Newark, New Jersey. And there I'm working with homeless youth. They're like 17 to 21, I think. And so they've been taken off the street and given a place to live. And we use songs in the same way to help them tell their stories about being homeless and what it's like. And coming off, you know, not just being homeless, but also their life, tell stories of their life. And then I've done things. I've gone to Africa. I went to Africa last year on a documentary project working with people in Johannesburg. And then in Botswana as well. The same thing, getting people to talk and using their words. All these Songwriting With programs, it all is basically the same principle, where if people talk, I can take their words and turn them into songs. So between all that stuff together, yeah, I'm writing a lot of songs these days.
It's incredible.
Probably more than ever.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I think I think one of the really instructive lessons here is that by using your gift to help facilitate someone else's creativity, you're often opening a window into your own, you know, and kind of creating sort of a feedback loop.
Well, I find this work to be really interesting, in that it feeds, you know, writing songs, like going, let's say, writing songs on my own, you know, it's one way of writing a song. It's generally slower and longer and maybe a bit more painful, but right. Very personal. Right. Then when I go to Nashville to write songs, or when I sit down to co-write songs here in Austin with people or wherever I am, I do it all over the place. That's like you got to bring something to the table, but you're really looking for your collaborator to join in. And it's a different kind of, you know, you could call it a different muscle. And then using that, using those sort of craft abilities in a situation, maybe with a room full of people that don't write songs.
Yeah.
You know, the same skills that I bring to sitting down to write by myself or writing with another professional songwriter, you know, that's how I can sit in a room with 10 people and come up with a song. The thing that's happened, though, which is interesting, is that doing it over and over and over with, say, everything from a room full of fourth graders to an auditorium full of juniors in high school to a corporation, you know, a room full of, like, corporate, you know, executives writing a song. Now when I go back to write with a professional songwriter, I find my ideas come much more fluidly and faster. It's kind of sort of up to my confidence level in that songs are endless. And the idea of a song, you know, it can be anything. And if one idea doesn't work, just move on. Don't get stuck. Just keep looking. And just so my ideas flow more fluidly than... For the most part, way more fluidly in a quote unquote professional songwriting setting than they did 10 years ago, and so these projects all feed each other. And what's been interesting to me is the more that I view this work not as separate from each other, they're not separate silos of my work.
Right.
They're the same silo. It's just different sort of methods or different sort of settings. Basically, I'm still writing songs, and I'm more fascinated than ever with the idea of taking some words, putting them in a melody, and it somehow creates this new thing that lives and it breathes and it goes on and on. And if it moves me and it moves the people in the room, there's a high likelihood that it will move someone that hears it, that puts their own sort of images behind it that aren't the images that we started out with. That's the magic of a song.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I've fallen more and more in love with that as time goes on, especially the last 10 years. I feel really blessed to have that.
You mentioned sitting down with somebody who doesn't write a song. And I know that tends to happen sometimes when you're doing appointment writing Nashville style. In fact, I spoke with your friend Radney Foster a few years ago, and he and Bill Lloyd were kind of bitterly chuckling about how sometimes you show up for one of these appointments and you're kind of writing the song for somebody else, basically, you know, while they're in the room with you. And to go back in time a little bit, I wonder how much of an adjustment it was for you to go from writing by yourself to doing that kind of co-writing where you're meeting somebody for the first time and writing a song.
Well, the transition from writing on your own to co-writing, it can be really difficult for some people. I kind of stumbled into it. I think the first person I ever co-wrote with was maybe Russell Smith from the Amazing Rhythm Aces.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to do it. And I think I was that guy that came in. Then Russell went, "Oh God, I got to write a song with this kid." I think I was that person actually. And because even though I've been writing on my own, you know, for what I don't know, years, I started writing songs when I was 10. You know, I didn't know how to do it. And but I met a guy named Boo Hewerding in London. I was introduced. I was taken over to London to write songs with Boo, and neither one of us had ever co-written. And it was so easy and so fluid with him because I didn't really have to do anything different. All I had to do was be me, and we were so different. He was English pop, and I was sort of Texas country folk, and I was fascinated with English pop music, and he was fascinated with sort of American folk music. And so everything I did, he loved, and everything he did, I loved. And so it was really easy. And so that the transition in the beginning wasn't that hard because it was, you know, once I got over the fact of like writing with someone, like once I kind of learned how it could be good.
Right.
And that to me, the value in it is write with somebody that's really different than you. Don't write, you know, I don't need to write with someone who's just like me because I can do that. I want to write with somebody who's really different that brings a level of songwriting or a musical perspective that I don't have and I can't touch. You know, I mean, one of my favorite guys to write with is Radney Foster, actually. Radney has such a deep understanding of country music and an incredible understanding and grasp of language, of simple language, and he comes at it from and storytelling, by the way. He's a brilliant storyteller in song, and so he comes at it from a really different, he brings a knowledge level that I just don't have. I can't even begin to touch that, and I have a thing that Radney doesn't, you know. And so when we get together, it's a collaboration. Another guy that I've written with a lot is Gary Nicholson,
right?
And the way Gary and I write is completely different than any other sort of writing collaboration I have. And what I do with Gary is I come in with just the wackiest ideas that I can bring to the table. And Gary kind of listens to him and he goes, "Oh, I like that one." I go, "Okay, great." And we start, and all I do is sit there and spew ideas at Gary, and he kind of edits. He barely picks up the guitar when we write. I kind of come in with the music, I come with the ideas, and if he doesn't like something, I just go on to a new idea. And Gary will go anywhere with me. He'll go any song direction I want to go. And it's really, we've been doing it for, you know, I don't know, 15 years. And it's really moving to sit down and do that. You know, by the same token, I sit down a lot of times with guys I don't know. The one thing I have found is that in a co-writing situation, I try to write with people that are better than I am, and I look at it as going to school.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to come out with a song necessarily. I know we're gonna come out with a song. And if you sit down with a good writer, for the most part, you're gonna come out with a good song. But what I try to do is learn from them. Because everyone has a different method, everyone has different ideas, everyone's coming from a different musical place, and everyone's listening to other music, like they have different input, you might say.
Right.
So I want to learn from them. I want to get better, and so I try to write with as good a people as I can, and I don't really worry about the product. I worry more about the process, and am I having a good time? Do I enjoy these people? Oh, look, and you know, oh, look how they got out of that situation, or look how they backed themselves into a corner intentionally so they could find their way out of it. And that's fascinating, and everyone has a different method, and I love that.
I was wondering if we could spend a little time talking about your evolution, you know, the way you kind of discovered your own musical identity. And begin by revisiting some of the turns that your music has taken over the course of your career, because, you know, you started out recording traditional Townes Van Zandt style Texas folk, and then you made kind of an abrupt pivot into a more produced sound with Little Victories. 1993, which was actually my introduction to your music. Not having heard the earlier records, when Deep Fantastic Blue came out in 96, I was kind of taken aback. And I guess the first question I have in regards to all that was whether or not Deep Fantastic Blue was any kind of conscious reaction to Little Victories.
No. No, first off, you know, let me back it up a little further than that. Because, you know, the first record I ever bought was Leon Russell Carney. I was in the fourth grade. And in the fourth grade as well, my guitar teacher taught me all of Neil Young's After the Gold Rush and Harvest. Right. And I also was very deep into Jim Croce. And you know, it's like fourth grade. I had all those records. You know,
pretty
so
hip
that's what I was.
Grader.
What's that?
That's a pretty hip fourth grader.
Well, I lived in this little town in Texas, and I was right between Houston, Austin, and San Antonio, and we picked up AM radio from all those places, and so I was able to pick all that up. So and you know, so if really those records, especially Carney, and Harvest. That's still how I hear music, and I was very into Willie Nelson. I was very into Jerry Jeff Walker and Guy Clark and Towns. Later in high school, I discovered Towns. But, you know, so I come from a Texas thing, but, you know, AM radio in the 1960s, it was across the board. I loved it, you know, it's like, right. I loved like stuff like America. You know, I remember listening like Sister, you know, Sister Golden Hair, whatever that song was called. I loved that song, you know. And it's like, you know, and so being in high school, I loved pop music. I just didn't listen to it very much. But when I wasn't a very good guitar player either. All I could play was country music. I mean, it's like all I could do was sort of that country folk thing. That's all I knew. I was deep into that. I learned how to write songs by rewriting Guy Clark songs, you know, and rewriting right. all the songs on Jerry Jeff Walker records. Trying to figure out how these guys told stories but I distinctly remember the first time I heard Elvis Costello watching the detectives at a party in college, and I just stood in front of the speakers and was going, what the hell is this, you know? and I was aware of pop music, but not really. But I went way off into the English thing, that, you know, the Pretenders, Elvis Costello, Rockpile, Nick Lowe, all that stuff, you know, and then later Crowded House and things like that. I got way into it. And meeting Boo and my friends in London that I met around that time, the guy that produced the record that Boo and I did, he also produced Trouble No More, this guy named Martin Lassels. He was a dance mixer.
Right.
And he did R&B and hip-hop stuff. And I used to stay with him all the time. In London. It's where I wrote Loving Arms. I wrote Loving Arms in his house. It's where Boo and I wrote our songs. It was in Martin's house. And he's an R&B producer. And so I heard all this music that I loved. And I was just kind of going, okay, can I meld these two things together, this sort of country folk way of telling a story with this other way of making records? And I began to feel, just like I just sort of transitioned, and part of that was meeting Boo, in that I found out that I could play this music that I liked listening to, and I didn't have to stay in one rhythm and one melody structure all the time. I could move. That's difficult, right? If you want to go make records and establish yourself as a sound. I forgot about that part. But I just sort of transitioned, and you know, my first record deal, I put out my first record myself. That was all the music I knew how to play. You know, I'm not a great musician. And then I got a record deal, you know, and Ray Benson produced the record, and for Epic in Nashville. Well, it's gonna sound kind of country if Ray Benson produces it, right. And I love that record. And then I got very frustrated with country music because I was writing these songs that were not going to fit in country music. And that's sort of the time, the era when country music was moving away from sort of left of center acts like Steve Earle and Nancy Griffith and Lyle Lovett and all stuff, and Katie Lang. They were sort of moving away from a traditional, country music structure was moving away from them. And I was like, okay, well, I can't be George Strait. There's no way I can be George Strait. I'm not even going to try. you know, I mean, you can't do it. He's George. It's like that. I can't out country those guys. And so I was really lucky that the very top guy at Sony Music, Tommy Mottola, saw me play and just kind of said to my A&R guy in Nashville, why is he in Nashville? And the guy goes, well, actually, he doesn't want to be here. And Tommy said, well, then let's get him out of here. And so, boom, my record deal got transferred to New York. It was like, it was a stroke of luck. And it was exactly what I wanted. And then I got the opportunity to explore. And when you're on a label like that, they kind of say, who do you want to work with? And I go, I want to work with like him or him or him or him. So I got the chance to go all around and work with all these different people, just trying to figure out what kind of record I wanted to make. And then I met Richard Goddard. And we met and we made little victories. You know, Richard wrote My Boyfriend's Back and he wrote Hang on Sloopy. You know, he produced Hang on Sloopy.
Right.
And he produced the first Joan Armour Trading and Marshall Crenshaw and Blondie. And it was like, hey, let's make a record. Let's do this. And it was a blast, man. But I was still telling stories. It was a guy with a guitar telling stories. And then, you know, 3 years later, I make Deep Fantastic Blue. Well, I'm in a different place. And then I kept moving.
Yeah, you did.
So things progressed. But if you listen to my record, like the record that I'm about to make, well, that's about to come out, Love Calling, some of the songs on it, they're not that far away from my very first independent record that came out in 1986. It's more acoustic, more country. It's like it's come full circle. That's great.
It's all very much of a piece.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of is what I want to talk about with the next studio set that you put out, which is Sunflower, which is mm-hmm. one of my favorite records of all time.
Oh, thank you.
And it's funny that you mentioned Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe, because I think that the records you put out between Sunflower and Marathon.
Circo?
Yes.
And Field of Crows?
Yes.
Yeah.
All of those, I think, they're almost like an American reflection of the stuff that Nick Lowe did after The Impossible Bird. You know, the tempo is down, the production is sparse. It's really all about the song, and it's like you're carving away all the inessential bits.
I almost quit playing music before I did Sunflower.
Right. I'm glad you didn't.
Because, I had a family and it was just too hard, and the business was, you know, when you come off a major label and you go away, when you go away off a major label, you go far, far, far away. And it was
especially
pretty dark.
In the 90s.
And it was tough, you know, and I couldn't figure out how to make records and how to feed my family. And I really thought about quitting, and some friends of mine talked me into doing one more record. They said, let's just do it with our friends. You know, fortunately, I have friends that are very good at what they do. But, you know, the deal was we sort of, Stuart Lehrman, who produced the record, and a friend of mine, Sammy Marandino, we sort of sat in a bar in New York City and went, okay, we sort of made a pact with each other. No one can be on the record if we don't like them as people. Let's only use our friends. Let's do exactly what we want to. We don't ask no one. I'm not asking anybody's opinion. I'm just going to make a record. See what happens. It's the last one. Let's go out swinging. And so I made Sunflower. It was exactly what I wanted to do. But it was like, let's take all the stuff that I don't want to be on my records. Let's take it off. Like, let's don't do it just because someone goes, oh, you should have that. Well, like, no, I don't want that. And I bought a nylon string guitar, and I was listening to a lot of Brazilian pop music from the 50s and 60s. And I was listening to a lot of Paul Simon music where it's really soft. And the rhythms are very soft. It's based around this acoustic guitar. And I mean, you listen to some of that old Brazilian pop music, it's all acoustic guitar and maybe a drum, or acoustic guitar and a bass and a singer. But it's, and So I started playing nylon string guitar all the time. And those records are based on, a lot of those records are based around nylon string guitars as well. Listening to a lot of programmed drums. And so like Sunflower and Serco, those are a lot of programmed drums. I was always fascinated with this idea of putting programmed drums and loops onto acoustic guitars, playing acoustic guitars against loops. I think it's a real hypnotic. For me, that was a real hypnotic. I loved it, you know. And and all three of those records were made with pretty much the same team. And it was what we wanted to do, but it was a transition. But it was taking it down, not trying to make an up record. I wanted to make quiet records.
I think all those albums, I don't know, they kind of quietly get under your skin, you know. They're uncommon in this era in that they're patient, you know. They don't grab you by the lapels. They wait for you to come around.
Thank you, that's a compliment.
And I guess that brings us to Love Calling, and I know that these songs weren't all written in one stretch, but they kind of hang together as almost like a concept album about love.
Well, I didn't mean it that way, but, you know, some of these songs are 5 years old.
Right.
And, a lot of them were written in Nashville. It comes from, the idea for this record came from, me going up to Nashville, writing songs and really enjoying it, really enjoying the process. But I couldn't, you know, getting anybody to listen to my songs was a challenge. So I thought I'd just make a record up there. I'd never made a record in Nashville. All my years of making records, I'd never recorded there. And I met John Randall Stewart years ago. I met him probably in 89. And met him in Switzerland, oddly enough. And he's just an amazingly talented, vibey guy. And I just had this idea one day, like, I want to make a record, I want John Randall to produce it, and I want to do it in Nashville, and I want to make it like acoustic. I want to make an acoustic record in Nashville. And it took us 4 years to finally figure it out and get the time and get the place, and you know, just had to wait for the time to be right. And and it was an amazing thing. We, you know, it was we pulled in a bunch of really great players. And it is, you know, I guess you could say it's a lot about love. The songs are about love, but it's just a collection of songs that seem to fit together. But I guess it does tell a story. I'm at a pretty good place in my life right now, and I have been for the last number of years, and so it's good.
Yeah, there's some domestic bliss on this record.
Yeah, most of my songs were like, "Hey, you ruined my life," and so yeah, you know, things go up and down. But I you know, as I get older, I have a lot of hope.
Right.
You know. Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of nice to let yourself write a song that's sort of positive. There's some darkness on this record too, though. I mean, there is.
So, I love that line. What is it? I smell smoke.
I smell smoke. Yeah.
You don't smoke, but I know who does.
Yeah, that was my daughter and I were walking down the street in Austin, and she goes, "Wow, I smell smoke." And it was like, you just rarely smell smoke these days.
Right. Right.
Especially in Austin, you know, everyone's so hip, you know. Healthy. And yeah, I just went, "God, that's a great concept. I smell smoke." And I took it to my buddy Jay Clementi in Nashville, and we wrote that song. So
now, does your work with your writing programs make it all at all difficult for you to follow the thread for songs that are just for you?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I know you said that all this stuff kind of feeds the other sides of what you're doing musically, but I guess it's just hard not to wonder, you're doing all this writing all the time, if it's if it's hard not to conserve the energy or preserve the thoughts that are for you know, Darden Smith, the recording artist, as opposed to everything else that you're doing in other areas. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah. Yeah. These you know, the different ways or different, you could call it different, arenas that I write in. They feed each other.
Yeah.
The thing that I've learned over the last, number of years is that there's a hunt, you know, it's like there's no shortage of songs. It's not like you have to save an idea because, you know, oh my God, that might be the last idea I have. That's a that's fear-based. That's a conserving. Just go for it, man. Just put it out there. You're not writing the Magna Carta. You're writing a song. You know, really, I mean, come on. Just give me, it's a song. There's another song. You can write another song. And even if you write a song with one idea, it doesn't work, write the idea again. Write the song again. It's like, it's not like it's some sort of piece of jewelry that's precious and you can't do it again or you can't change it. You know, there's really only a couple of song ideas anyway. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. I mean, it's like, really, I mean, come on. It's like, you know, you can tell a story, you know, it's like just write the song. Don't get too precious about it because there's more songs. I mean, Gary Nicholson has a great way of saying it. He said, basically it's like a water faucet. If you never turn the water faucet on, it kind of rusts up right. And it's kind of harder to turn it on. And when you do turn it on, brown water comes out until it gets clear. But if you walk over every day and turn the water faucet on, first off, it turns really easily, and clear water comes out quick. So turn the dang water faucet on every day. Turn your creativity on every day. Write something every day. You know, just write. Pick up your guitar every day. Do something creative every day. And then when you sit down to do it and you got it and it's time to turn it on, boom, you turn it on. I was at a songwriting, we did a songwriting with a soldiers retreat this past weekend.
Right.
I wrote 11 songs. No, 10. I wrote 10 songs. 10 songs. Between Friday at 10 p.m. and Sunday at noon. I wrote 10 songs. That's just turning it on.
That's just turning it on, yeah.
And being available and utilizing the words of other people in the room. Just turn it on. Don't be afraid of it. And don't like hold it back going, oh my God, that's the best idea on the planet. You know, just write the song.
Yeah. That
that works for me. That may not be right for everybody, but that works for me.
Well, I think it's terrific advice. I mean, I was just talking to a songwriter yesterday who looks at his writing in terms of windows of availability, I guess, you know, where he goes through periods where he doesn't write and then he'll start again. But every time he starts again, he's got to get that brown water out, you know, like he has to write a few crappy songs to get back in the zone again.
That's the truth with everyone. I mean, like, yeah. You know, it's like, I don't write songs every day.
Right.
You know, and so it might be a couple of weeks. I'll write snippets.
Right.
But, you know, it's like you sit down to actually go through a major writing thing. Yeah, I mean, everybody does that. That's the process.
Was there ever, was there kind of a catalyst for this record in terms of a song that made you feel like you had an album? Or did it not come together like that?
At a certain point, you look up and you go, right, these hang together. Right. I've got 15, 16, 17 songs that hang together. I think we started the process with 20 songs and we narrowed it down to 11.
Okay.
But at some point you look up and you go, okay, I think we got it, you know? And then you try to top those. You don't start writing until the last day of, you don't stop writing until the last day before the recording session.
Right.
You just keep going. You just keep trying to knock those songs off the list. Can I get one better? Can I get one better? Can I get one better? I don't stop until I'm there. Actually, I think one of these songs was written like 2 weeks before the session.
You gave a really great TED talk about fearing right. your gift, I was reminded of that this morning because I was reading an older interview with you where you were talking about how you wrote that symphony piece. And
right.
when you did it, you said you were scared shitless, but you did it anyway. And I think there's something instructive there for artists, you know, for creative people about embracing that fear.
Well, I mean, there's different kinds of fear, you know, probably. For me, you know, I'm always, you know, I have my own kinds of fear and the things that I'm afraid of. And, you know, but the one thing I've learned about fear is that most of the time, especially artistic fear and creativity fear, is that usually it's in your brain. It's just a figment of your imagination. And I can speak for myself. I'm afraid to fail, and I'm afraid to look stupid, and in some ways I'm afraid that if it succeeds, what is that going to mean? And how will that change? And so getting over those has been, as far as my work life, it's been a constant thing that I've had to come back and revisit. And every time I revisit it, it looks a little differently and it gets a little deeper. But getting past that little voice inside of your head that goes, you can't, is a big thing, man, because you actually can do things. You know, it might not look like other people, and you may not be the best on the planet. But, I mean, I don't read music, and I wrote a symphony. I collaborated with a team, you know. I mean, I had a team. But, I mean, you know, I never dreamed that I would sit down and have a program like Songwriting with Soldiers either, where I'm writing with veterans and soldiers. It's like, what's that about, you know? I'm not a military guy. I go and sit down in a room full of fifth graders and dig it, like have a blast, like totally have a blast, or sit down in a room with homeless people and dig it, like really have a blast doing it, and walk out of there feeling like that's as important to me as a gig at Carnegie Hall. Okay, it's the same vibe. So not being afraid of that part of me that allows me to do all those things. And not go, oh, well, I'll do that, but that's only, you know, I'm not going to tell anybody I'm doing this work. You know, I'm just like, it's like, yeah, man, this is what I am. This is who I am. Not being afraid of that has been huge. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And it wasn't like that all the time. It wasn't like that. I used to be really very hesitant about really being me. I think that's what we're afraid of. We're afraid to be ourselves. You know, we're afraid to be... as powerful or as creative as we naturally are. I think we're afraid of it because we're afraid, you know, everyone's got different reasons. Some people are afraid to show other people up because they're so amazing that they know they're just going to blow everybody else out of the water. And so they hold themselves back. Other people are afraid they don't have enough, you know, and, for whatever the reasons that people may have, getting past that and just be yourself, you know. I think that's what people respond to, you know. It's what people love is when someone is really honest and themselves, you know. I mean, I was listening to Howlin' Wolf the other night.
Mm-hmm.
Not a great singer. I mean, not like, you know, not like a great singer, but God, I'm so glad Howlin' Wolf sings like he does. Because it says a lot. That's why I listen to Howlin' Wolf. I don't want like polish. I want Howlin' Wolf.
And that'll do it for this episode of A Fine Mess. Thank you to Darden Smith for taking the time to talk. Thank you for listening, and meet me back here in a few weeks, knock on wood, for a conversation with comedian Brian Moot. Until then, this has been A Fine Mess.